Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We are reading in Book 2, Canto 2, The Kingdom of Subtle Matter. And we've come to the end of the canto. Last week, we read the section which begins on page 113, near the top. So we just read that canto. Today, we'll have a look. We'll have a look at this last section of Canto 2 before we move up to Canto 3. Page 113 at the break. I think we'll start at the top today. We usually start at the bottom, but we can start at the top today. Matthew, will you read? Exactly, yes. You just read. The first few lines.
In that fair, subtle realm behind our own, the form is all, and physical gods are king.
Continue, please. You can continue to...
The inspiring light plays in fine boundaries. A faultless beauty comes by nature's grace. There, liberty is perfection's guarantee. Although the absolute image lacks, the word incarnate, the sheer spiritual ecstasy. All is a miracle of symmetric charm, a fantasy of perfect line and rule.
Go on, please.
There, all feel satisfied in themselves and whole. A rich completeness is by limit made. Marvel in an utter littleness abounds. An intricate rapture riots in a small space. Each rhythm is kin to its environment. Each line is perfect, and each object faultlessly built for charm and use. All is enamored of its own delight. Intact it lives of its perfection sure, in a heaven-pleased, self-glad immunity, content to be. It has need of nothing more.
Thank you. So this is Sri Aurobindo's summary of his description of the kingdom of subtle matter, he calls it. That fair, subtle realm behind our own. This kingdom of subtle matter is very close to our kingdom of gross matter. It is supporting it and shaping it. And things that are already realized in the kingdom of subtle matter will be realized here in our physical world. But like our world, it's a world of form. There, the form is everything, all the shapes and objects. And the rulers of that world are physical gods. They're not gross material gods like those who control our world, but they are still physical gods. It's a world of great beauty. He says the inspiring light plays in that world, but it plays within boundaries, fine boundaries, beautiful boundaries. A faultless beauty comes by nature's grace. It is the nature of that world to give and create beauty. And their freedom is a perfection, is a guarantee of perfection. If all the things, all the movements there are free, then naturally it will give rise to perfection. But in that world, he says, the absolute image is not there. It's not the pure original image which has been expressed on all the different planes. That is lacking. The word incarnate is not embodied in that world. And there we cannot experience the sheer, utter spiritual ecstasy. But still, everything is miraculously beautiful. A miracle of symmetric charm, a fantasy of perfect line and rule. And because it's so beautiful and so spontaneous, Everything there feels absolutely self-satisfied, satisfied in itself, feels complete. It has no feeling of dissatisfaction, of lacking anything. A rich completeness is made by the limitations, the physical limitations of that world. There, marvel, wonder, amazement is abounding. There's so much of it, but within an utter littleness. It is, like our own world, very limited. There, the delight, he says, is an intricate rapture, which is playing joyfully in a small space. But there, each rhythm is kin, is in harmony with its environment. Each line is perfect and inevitable. Each object faultlessly built for charm and use. And we saw in the previous earlier weeks that that is why this world of subtle matter is one where artists and creative people, they can contact that world for their inspiration to achieve perfect form here in our world. There, in that world, all is enamored of its own delight. It's in love with its own delight, its enjoyment of its environment. Everything feels intact, safe, secure, immune. It lives sure that it is perfect. And because it is perfect, it can last. It will not decay or be damaged. It lives in a heaven-pleased, self-glad immunity. It feels immune and safe, and it feels that this is a heavenly paradise surrounding it, and it's pleased with itself because itself is perfect. No? Each thing, every movement and person and being there is content to be. It just feels satisfied with its existence and it doesn't need anything more. So in that way, it's very different from our world where we always have this feeling of being of insufficiency. However perfect something is, we could always imagine a bit more, a bit different, a bit better. No? And that's the whole basis of our human movements. No? Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask any questions about that line, those lines? Don?
Well, perhaps being here on Earth, it's very important for us to see change and evolution from a poorer state to a better state. This is a tremendous part of our history and so on. Yeah. It seems to be lacking.
Well, this is a what we call a typal world. It's a world which is a plane of existence in which progress is not happening. All the typal worlds are like that. For us, it's impossible to imagine a world without at least change. It may not always be progress, it may not always be better, but the destiny of our world, Sri Aurobindo tells us, is evolution towards higher and higher perfection. But this world is already perfect within its limits. Well, that's why, of course, King Aswapati moves on. But nevertheless, for a person who has a brief contact with that world, it's very, very alluring. No? Yes, Lyupa?
The cantonment, human of the subject. So is this description of the subtle matter?
Yes, yes.
And it means that it is not kind of progressing.
It is not a progressive world. And many things are lackings, important things. But what is there is just perfect. Yes, Paula.
Does it correspond to the description in the agenda of the subtle physical world where mother was in?
I don't want to go into that.
Okay.
Excuse me. Let's stick to the text. Yes. I don't know enough to go into that. It's easier to stick to Sri Aurobindo's words. And what he's going to say next is really remarkable. Would you read, Larry?
Yes. So does it mean even the negative qualities are there and perfect?
Yes, that's what we read a couple of weeks back. Come, Loretta, take a seat. That the characteristic of that word is perfect form. And it gives perfect form even to things that we would consider dangerous and wrong. But the form is perfect. It lends grace, he says, to the demon and the snake, no? Something like that. They become alluring. I don't find that line right now. But there's several important things missing from this world of perfect form.
Absolute image, right? It lacks the absolute image, the word incarnate.
And the incarnate word, the word of creation is not there. Yes. And now he's going to speak of some other things that are missing from there. Larry.
Can you sing a line?
We finished with the line, content to be, it has need of nothing more. Let's read on from there.
Here was not futile efforts, broken heart, exempt from the ordeal and the test, empty of opposition and of pain. It was a world that could not fear nor breathe. It had no grace of error or defeat. It had no room for fault, no power to fail. Out of some packed self-bliss, it drew at once its form discoveries of the mute idea and the miracle of its rhythmic thoughts and acts, its clear technique of firm and rounded lines, its gracious people of inanimate shapes and glory of breathing bodies like our own. Amazed, his senses ravished with delight, he moved in a divine yet kindred world, admiring marvelous forms so near to ours, yet perfect, like the playthings of a god, deathless in the aspect of mortality. In their narrow and exclusive absolutes, the finite's rank supremacies throned abide. It dreams not ever of what might have been. Only in boundaries can this absolute live. In the supremeness bound to its own plan, where all was finished and no widths were left, no space for shadows of the immeasurable, no room for the incalculable surprise, a captive of its own beauty and ecstasy. In a magic circle wrought the enchanted might. The spirit stood back, effaced behind its frame.
Thank you.
385. Power to fail.
Yes, isn't this interesting what he says? He describes things about our world which we find regrettable. No? Futile efforts, broken heart. No? That only happens here. There's no challenges, no tests and ordeals. There's no opposition, no pain. It's a world in which fear and grief just can't happen. And then he says it had no grace of error and defeat. We don't think of error of when we make mistakes or when we feel we've made such great efforts and we feel that they're defeated. We rarely have the insight to think of these things as a grace, as a gift, a divine blessing.
Isn't the grace capital?
No.
Only it's just a grace which is like
Just a grace. So that's really something to make us think about our world. No? To some of her disciples, Mother has said, try to be grateful for everything. No? Maybe the things that seem to us most undesirable, most unwanted, actually, this is a grace which is peculiar to our world of evolutionary progress. These things are needed for progress.
Can you explain the meaning of grace here? No, grace, like the divine grace.
When something comes like a blessing, it's a grace. Where did it come from? How have I deserved this? It's just come. So sometimes we think of things. I mean, a couple of days ago, I had such a wonderful working day, and at the end of the day, I had to say, thank you. It was a grace to have a day like that. But then there are other days which are just terrible. I mean, we don't think that this may be a grace too, that we should say, thank you for those challenging days, for those days when things happen, and we think, my God, how could it happen? So this is Sri Aurobindo giving us new insights. We have to be grateful also for the fact that in our world we can make mistakes. Mistakes happen, thank God. We get defeated, we work hard for something to be fulfilled, and then it just goes all wrong. Thank God. Yes?
We are trying to understand this plane of subtle matter. So is there no clash of so-called good or evil?
It's not part of the value system there.
No, it's maybe not for me. When I'm visiting that subtle where there's no defeat or effort or all those things. But there must be the two types of forces acting against each other in conflict.
That's something that's peculiar to our world. That's only there because of evolution and conflict and growth and development. There, everything's just perfect all the time. There's no progress. No progress needed because everything's perfect from the beginning. We, as I say, it's very difficult for us to imagine worlds where there's no progress because progress is absolutely the keynote of our world. And because it is so, then we have to face these oppositions and pains and disappointments and errors and defeats. I think this is absolutely wonderful what Sri Aurobindo is telling us here. Yes, Margaret.
For me it comes a question that if this world is something connected to this state of equality, so to see it, but also to see the other movement of this progress. And as you said, in this world, is there the progress there?
I suppose if it's a world which is concerned primarily with beautiful form, then there's a whole range of different kinds of delight and enjoyment, but the focus is that. Perfect form. Let's read on because, how does King Aswapati react to this? Yes, Luba.
Our dense matter, as I understood, just came down from the subtle matter, isn't it?
It says out of its fall, that means the lowest levels of that world, things get dense and yeah. Our denser matter
so,
came.
And this means this creation, this manifestation, this whole evolution. So I can't understand how this seventh
so
is not
what we evolve by moving from one step of this ladder to another.
Yeah.
The steps remain the same. They don't change. But we move from down to up, and the soul has already moved from up to down. But each of these is a plane which is fixed
so
in its...
They are not undergoing the evolution as we are going.
Those worlds are not evolving. That's why they're called tidal worlds.
You know, the subtle things, they're
no, they're fixed. And that's why, of course, it is said that the gods of these subtle realms, if they want to experience the psychic being and progress, they have to associate themselves with our world. They have to somehow incarnate or join onto our world. And what we can do, we can visit them and learn things or gain experiences there, which help us to rise higher or to go lower, also it happens. So all these worlds now, these worlds that are described in this 15 cantos, there's actually more than 15 because several of them have different levels described in each canto. But these are all, we could say, involutionary tidal worlds. And that's what's unique about our world, is that it is moving in the opposite direction up the ladder.
Can that be a digress also? Like, you move up, can it happen that the movement can be dominant?
Yes, it can happen. But it happens on an individual level, not for the whole world. No? It's the soul, the individual soul, that moves down and up the ladder, if I've understood correctly. But these are the rungs of the ladder. The steps, those are fixed. He mentions it, no? If we go back to the end of book one.
The commentary about falling from the higher realms.
It seems to have different levels in this world, no? Where does it come, where it says? Yeah. Out of its fall, on page 107. So, let me read that, no? Its knowledge, this is at the page of 107, this its knowledge, that's the knowledge of the kingdom of subtle matter. It's a starting point, our error. Its beauty puts on our material mask, our mud mask, ugliness. There it's full of this artist good, but that can be a beginning to what on earth we would think of as evil. So on its higher levels, there's a heaven of creative truths above, that's its highest levels. In between, there's a cosmos, a whole universe of harmonious dreams. And below, in the lower levels, all that gets muddled up. There's a chaos of dissolving forms below. That's the transition to our world. It plunges lost in our inconscient base, the base of unconsciousness, which is the base of our material world. So out of its fall, our denser matter came. That's the difference. Our matter is dense and fixed. There things are more fluid. So let's go back to page... at the bottom of page 112, actually, he compares that world and our world. Here, we may receive touches from that higher world, and that brings us joy from diviner heights and glimpses of inspiring thought. But here in our world, we don't get the utter, complete vision and delight. Deliberately, there's a veil is kept. We are not shown the perfect existence. Because if we were, we would become captives of its beauty and joy. We'd be so fascinated with that perfect beauty of the subtle material worlds that our souls would forget to aspire to higher things. So that's why the imperfections of our world are a grace, because coded into us is this aspiration for higher states. And our environment here doesn't allow us to forget that. So the last line that was read, the spirit stood back. The true divine spirit is effaced behind its frame, It's as if you have a wonderful painting by a great master artist, but the frame in which it has been put is so fantastic that you don't really see the picture. So it's something like that. The spirit is effaced in that world. We only see the beautiful form, the flame. The spirit which is behind can be forgotten. So let's read on from there. Do you like to read, Mom? Back road?
Me?
Yes.
Admired for the bright finality of its lines, a blue horizon limited the soul. Thoughts moved in luminous facilities, the outer ideal's shallows, its swim range. Life in its boundaries lingered satisfied with the small happiness of the body's act. Assign this force to a bound corner mind, attached to the safe paucity of holding. She did her little works, and played and slept, and thought not of a greater work undone, forgetful of her violent vast desires, forgetful of the heights to which she rose, her walk was fixed within a radiant groove. The beautiful body of a soul at ease, like one who laughs in sweet and sunlit groves. Childlike, she swung in her gold cradle of joy. The spaces called reached not her charmed abode. She had no wings for wild and dangerous flight. She faced no peril of sky or of abyss. She knew no vistas and no mighty dreams, no yearning for her lost infinitudes.
Thank you. So that world has a beautiful horizon, absolutely perfect, admired for the bright finality of its lines. A blue horizon limited the soul in this world of perfect form. The soul is limited, its experience and its possibilities are limited. Thought is limited. It moves in luminous facilities. Beautiful, illumining words, but they're kind of easy. They have no depth to them. The outer ideal shallows its swim range. There is an ideal world, but if the ideals are only outer, only concerned with physical things, they are not deep like oceans. They are shallows. You can paddle there, but you can't swim deeply. Thought is limited, and life is also limited, but it's satisfied with its limits. It lingers satisfied in its boundaries. It's satisfied with the small happiness of the body's acts, because this is a physical world. Life is the force which has to implement mind. But the mind that it has been asked to implement, to act as the force for, is a very limited mind, shut in a corner with no great possibilities. That mind is attached, or the life that serves it is attached to this little room that she's given. So life does her little works, and she plays, and she sleeps, and she never thinks that there are greater things to be done that are being neglected. She can move around, she can even move around freely, but her life is a groove, on tracks. So that's just beautiful. Life there is the beautiful body of a soul at ease. You may remember the picture, or you can have a look at it as you go out. Life swinging in her hammock in the beautiful garden. The beautiful body of a soul at ease. Like one who laughs in sweet and sunlit groves. Childlike she swung in her gold cradle of joy. And when Mother saw Hooter's picture, she said, ah, she's lazy. Life has such vast possibilities, we will see them in the next canto, but in that world, she's limited. It's beautiful, but still, the space is called, the call of the vastnesses, doesn't reach that magical space where she lives. And she doesn't have wings for wide and dangerous flight. She might have little wings like a butterfly, you know, but she can't fly high like an eagle or a condor. You know. So there she's protected. Life is safe, immune, we had earlier. You know. She faced no peril of flying up into the heights or down into the abyss. And she doesn't have any far views, a vista. It's when you can look a long way. There's something in us which likes that, that the view is not limited, that we can look a far distance, nor a wide perspective. And no mighty dreams. So she doesn't even think of yearning for her lost infinitudes, the infinite possibilities of life. She's just happy with her little limited space there. Yes?
Could this be describing also potential future human world, where either very sterile, but the fact of the state, a construct that actually, to some extent, certain parts of humanity are striving towards in this time, a couple of cells? You know, noticing.
Yes, of course, these. How could we say, some of this is in us also, no? We're just delighted with a perfect picture or a perfect life, even if it's limited. No? But the soul is not satisfied. And that's why King Aswapati has to move on. I don't know whether that's an adequate answer to your question. Yes, Don?
What brings to my imagination there is the child of a very wealthy family born into the wealth and all.
Everything, yeah.
Of course it isn't.
No, because you are human, you will look for something else. Maybe that child of born into a family where they have everything, maybe he'll go and work in the slums.
Maybe he will, or maybe he won't.
Maybe he won't, yeah. And that depends, it depends on many things. But ultimately it should depend on the choice of the soul, what is the experience the soul wants. But if the physical environment is very perfect, and the life is satisfying, and there's enough mental interest, then perhaps it will linger satisfied for a long time. We don't know. That's why this grace of error and defeat comes along, to remind us that it's not as perfect as all that, and there are other possibilities. Yes, Lorraine?
Well, with the mass media, you know, movies and radio and this and that and theater and all sorts of things, we're all getting inundated with...
with forms, with form, appearances.
And the extremes of media and really
yes.
Heavy, doing dangerous things.
Yes.
So,
you feel it?
So pulled apart, you know, crushed at times, and then, you know, more extreme.
So that's why it's so important to find this innermost, Medananda called it our compass, as if we have a compass deep in the heart which can tell us where we are and where we should be going. That's the most important thing, to find that psychic being, that compass. And of course, King Aswapati has that very strongly. So that's what comes next.
Sir,
yes?
Like in Thoughts and Aspirations, it also talks about animals have content and the gods have content. Man is only dissatisfied.
Yes.
It relates everything what it is saying here, no?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
And if everything, the environment, everything is rich, you don't have to do anything, but the
Buddha who born in the last
family. Yes, and he felt, I have to go, because he became aware of the imperfections of the world. And his soul within him felt, I have to do something about this. No? Perhaps we're all here because of some feeling like that.
Yes.
Yes, Paula.
What is the significance of the feminine pronoun?
She, this is life, the goddess of life.
But it isn't capitalized. So
sorry.
Earlier in this canto, there's not a personification of that force.
But that comes in the next canto. We will. Really, it does. Yes. The first section of the next canto is so wonderful. You will see. Yes.
Sri Aurobindo dictating this, he was dictating, he was telling, put capital S.
Well, in this part of the book, he was not dictating.
But when he was dictating, do you think...
That's much later. This is from, I think the dictation started from book 4 or 5 onwards. Mm-hmm. Then we cannot be so sure, and sometimes we may think, oh, did Sri Aurobindo really mean this? Mm-hmm. But up to the end of book 3, we, so far as we know, he has revised it so many times, so carefully, with such attention to detail. Mm-hmm. But of course, then his handwriting got handed over to somebody who had to type it, and then somebody else had to compose it for printing, and then the proofs were read out to Sri Aurobindo. By that time, his eyesight was not so good. So it is possible that also in these earlier stages, some small things may have crept in. Personally, I don't feel that any of these small imperfections affect the value of this immense gift that he has given us. No. And I think that great efforts have been made in the Sri Aurobindo archives to make this text as accurate as possible. And they have published lists of the changes they've made in earlier editions, so that if anybody disagrees with them, they can check, make their own. And nowadays we are all allowed to have our own reading and understanding of Savitri. So I think we shouldn't make too much of this capitalization. Personally, I'm one of these people who is very distressed that on page 3, in line 78, it says, all can be done if the God touch is there.
Yeah.
And it's got a small g. In all the previous editions, it had a big G, but okay, who cares? I mean, I do care, but not much, really. Other things are more important. Shall we read to the end of the canto?
Just one question?
Yes, Sebastian. Sorry, which line?
411.
Shallows. Oh, yes, so... You go to a nice holiday beach, and the children will paddle in the shallows, but their daddies will swim out into the deeps. You know? Yeah. So this life here, is it, or that world, 411? Thought. I've had a dream like this once, that I was standing on a kind of a sand spit, and there was an ocean on one side and there was an ocean on the other side. And I could choose which ocean I wanted to swim in. And one of them was so deep. And the other one, it didn't matter how far you went in, it still was shallow. I don't know really what it symbolized, but for me, moving into that deep ocean seemed much more satisfying. The other one, you kept thinking, oh, there's a big wave going to come, but it never got deep. I don't know what it meant. So, who's ready to read? Yes, please. Yes.
Can hear you.
Can you make your voice a little louder?
Louder.
Just the voice.
Of the picture in a perfect frame, his praying artistry could not keep his will, only a moment when release it gave. A careless hour was spent in a silent
slight bliss.
Our split trees
tires
of beginning's surface. Then seconded it the spell the door of the poem. It turns to hidden powers and deeper space. So now he looked beyond the for greater light. His soul speak crying of dawning in each ear. His little light country yard of the house of days. He left that fine material paradise. His destiny lay beyond in large space.
Thank you. So this world of subtle matter is like a perfect picture in a perfect frame, but it does keep his attention. Asvapati is on a quest. He knows what he's looking for. This is not satisfying. He's being led by his immense will to find a principle, a power that can bring about a divine life in the material world. That's what he's looking for. And this subtle physical world, well, it's a perfect picture in a perfect frame. But that's all it is. It's not as satisfying. Can't keep his will. His will leads him further on. That beautiful world, it is a nice place to spend a weekend, a moment's fine lucid game, relax a little bit. No? A careless hour was spent in a slight bliss, a small, unimportant delight. No? This is because our spirit, our human spirit, eventually gets tired of the surfaces of things. It wants to go deeper, and it wants to go beyond form. However beautiful the form is, it can't be satisfied just by form. It wants to go beyond the splendor of the form. So it turns away from the surfaces and the forms to hidden powers and deeper states of consciousness. So now King Asvapati looks beyond that, what is it called? That fair, subtle realm behind our own. He looks beyond that for a greater light, a greater illumination. His soul is climbing up to a high peak, which he couldn't see. He only knows that peak is there, but he couldn't see it. It was beyond the realm of sight. So, but he's continuing his climb, and he abandons behind him the subtle world, this brilliant courtyard of the house of days. It's just a very beautiful entranceway to a much vaster mansion, the house of days. So he left that fine material paradise. His destiny lay beyond in larger space.
So then
That line is really very interesting. As in play, for instance, a perfect picture in a perfect play.
Yes. Ah, but you see, this picture has a meaning.
Yes,
that's what I'm telling you.
It's not just, you might possibly win a photographic competition, perhaps, with the perfection of the picture, and you might congratulate the craftsman on having made a perfect frame. But what's really important about that picture is that it is the ashram, and that behind there, where we don't see it, is the samadhi, and Sri Aurobindo's room, and Mother's room.
Yeah, it is visible.
Siddhi is room, and Mother's room is also visible.
Yes. Well, we can see them from the outside,
yeah.
But there's an inside,
yes,
to that picture. So that makes a difference. That's what's important. Those are the hidden powers.
So I remember the house of days.
He seems to mean all the that vast mansion which has been described in Book 1, Canto 5, towards the end, which contains all the possibilities of time and space, of the manifestation.
Do you have a sense of why that word is used?
Days.
Yeah.
It might be because days include nights. We don't have only days, we don't have just one day. There's always there's a progression, and there's also the alternation. That's one of the characteristics of our world, is this complementariness of apparent opposites. Day and night is just one example. Life and death is another. These are inseparable, apparently contradictory things which need each other. But perhaps something like that. Our world is a house of days. It has the light and the dark. Maybe it's something like that. If anybody has a better explanation, welcome. Yes?
Could it be a reference to, like, the Ancient of Days?
It could. The Ancient of Days, yes. The Ancient of Days is the Creator who's created all this. What he's created is the house of days. And he lives in it.
The other explanation would be describing the subtle words that everything is good. So all brightness, all...
I don't say that everything is good. It is not true. In this particular subtle world, everything is beautiful. We are going to go to some subtle worlds that are absolutely not good at all. So let's be careful about the words.
So,
yes.
In this world, it is all day or all night, day and night.
No, the everlasting day is right at the end.
In this one, it is that the day and night are there. I don't remember the
past. I also don't remember. You can do some homework. So, if you like, we can, for Paula's sake, we can move on towards the next canto, the glory and the fall of life, and we can risk. Amazing first section. It starts on page 316. So Aswapati is moving out, or has moved beyond the kingdom of subtle matter. And first he passes through a kind of transitional area, which is described next. Would you read, Sebastian?
Sure. Glory and fall of life. An unknown growth, a sentinel over his feet, answering a greater nature's trouble call. He crossed the limits of a morning mind and entered wide obscurity, his pure field, where all was doubt and change and nothing sure. A world of search and toil without response.
Repose.
Without repose. As one meets the face of the unknown. Questioner with none to give reply, attracted to a problem never solved, always uncertain of the ground he trod, always drawn to an inconstant goal. He traveled through a land peopled by doubts, in shifting confines on a quaking base, in front he sought a boundary ever unreached. and brought himself at each step nearer now, far retreating horizon of mirage, a beggar scene of there that grew in a home, a journey of countless path without clothes, nothing he found to satisfy his heart, a tireless wandering soul he could not achieve.
Cease. Mm. Thank you. Next, please.
Their life is the manifest in a movement of unquiet seas, a long and dangerous leap of spirit into space, a vast disturbance in the eternal calm, an impulse and passion of the infinite, assuming whatever shape or fancy, escaped from this restraint of settled forms. She has left the safety of the time and the moment. When shepherded by the fear that walks through time, undaunted by fate that dogs and chance that springs, she accepts disaster as a common risk. Careless of suffering, heedless of sin and fall, she wrestled with danger and discovery in the unexplored expanses of the soul. To be seen only another experiment, the hazard of a seeking ignorant force that tries all truths and, finding not supreme, moves on unsatisfied, unsure of its end.
Thank you. So this she here, this is life. No?
She is life.
Life, life. In line 21 it says, their life is. So one could perhaps think that maybe there should be a capital. But anyway, all this she that follows, this is life. And she's unsatisfied, moving on, unsatisfied. Yes, please, would you read? Regine.
As source of inner mind, so life was shaped. From thought to soul, thought she passed from face to face, pushed by her own powers of proud and rest. Now master of herself, now toy and slave. A huge inconsequence was her action's law, as if all possibility must be drained, and anguish and bliss were pastimes of her heart. In a gallop of thunder proved vicissitudes, she swept through the race fields of circumstance. All swaying, she tossed between your height and deep, uplifted or broken on time's inconstant wheel, amid the tedious crawl of dread desires, she lit her life with warmth in nature's love. Then Titan's stature took all earth for food, and with hands she sees for robe, for crown, the stars, and shouting throat from peak to giant peak, clamoring for words to conquer and to rule.
Thank you. Back row there, please.
Then, not longing an hour of solar space, she plunged from the anguish of the depths, and the bellowing clung to her own say, in dolorous commerce with her squalid self, she wrote the upon of all that she had lost, or sat with grief, as with an ancient friend, the room of wild raptures soon was spent, or she lingered, tied to an inadequate joy, missing the lens of faith, missing life's door. A scene was planned for all the numberless moods, and each could be the love and way of life, but none could offer a pure feeling. Only a thing they left behind are the fierce breast that brings a dead fatigue. Amid her ship unfold variety, something remained dissatisfied, ever the same. And in the new saw only the face of the world, for ever repeated all the rest, and every change prolonged the same unease.
Thank you, Naren.
A spirit of us
self and aim and show, tried soon,
tired.
Too much joy, tired of too much joy and happiness. She needs the spur of pleasure and of pain, and the native taste of suffering and unrest. She strains for an end that never can she bring. A perverse savior haunts her trusting lips for the grief she weeps, which came from her own choice, for the pleasure yearns that wrecked with bounds of her breast. Aspiring to heaven, she turns her steps towards hell. Chance she has chosen and danger for playfellows. Fate's dreadful swing she has taken for cradle and seat, yet pure and bright from the tenderness she was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home.
Thank you. So we've just read a brief description of life as we know it. Its characteristics are dissatisfaction, endless seeking, enjoyment of all extremes. This is so different, in such a contrast to the previous canto, where everything was satisfied within its limits, in that perfect world. There life was restricted, but now she has all possibility to play with. And she's not at all fearful. She's undaunted by the threats of fate and unexpected chance. All that's just part of her journey. She accepts disaster as a common risk. She wrestles with danger and discovery in the unexplored expanses of the soul. So for life, just existence is a long experiment in which everything can be tried out. She moves on unsatisfied. And she's guided by some inner mind. According to the thoughts of that mind, life shapes her action. She moves from one thought to another thought, from one phase to another phase, tortured by her own powers. Often they cause her a lot of pain, or proud and blessed. Sometimes she's master of herself, sometimes she's the toy and slave of her impulses. A huge inconsequence was her action's law. Life is irrational. It's not logical and sequential. It's always looking for something new and unexpected. It's as if all possibility must be drained, and the extremes of anguish and of bliss, this is something pastimes of the heart, what the heart enjoys. So he gives some examples of that, the way that life rushes along in this gallop on wild horses of thunder-hoofed vicissitudes. The horse is a symbol, Vedic school, of vital energies. So sometimes our vital horses, they just carry us away, galloping, not caring what obstacles come up. Or she varies. She tosses between the heights and the deeps. There are people like that, who are sometimes highly elated, and other times they're deep in depression. It's the life force, up and down. And it's as if there's a wheel, time's inconstant wheel. That wheel goes round and round. Sometimes she's on the top, enjoying. Sometimes she's crushed beneath it. And sometimes she just enjoys being like a worm in nature's mud, wriggling around and enjoying that. And other times she's full of ambition to conquer the whole universe. And sometimes she indulges, you can notice this in yourself, in self-pity. wantonly enamored. She falls in love with sorrow. She plunges into the anguish of the depths, and wallowing, clung to her own misery. You might have noticed this sometime, that when you something plunges you into misery and people come along and try and tell you to cheer up, there's something here that just clings, that doesn't want to be comforted. It's wallowing in its misery. And then she likes to talk about her sorrows, or write about them. She wrote the account of all that she has lost, or sits with grief as with an ancient friend. And sometimes she indulges in a romp like children, violent play, a romp of violent raptures soon was spent. But another thing that happens in our life is that we linger tied to an inadequate joy. We know it's not the real thing, but still it's what we've got and we don't want to let it go. So in this symbol world which Aswapati is seeing now, a scene was planned for all life's numberless moods. And each of them, in one or other of those scenes, could be the law and way of life. She can enjoy them all, but none of them can give her a pure felicity, pure bliss. Honest, this enjoyment, this flickering zest was left behind, or the fierce lust that brings a dead fatigue. And through all this variety, that's actually the outstanding characteristic of life. Mind wants progress, life wants variety, change. But amongst all this untold variety, something remained dissatisfied, ever the same. And the new things come, and it's just actually the old ones in disguise. Every hour repeats the rest, and every change prolongs the same unease, the same dissatisfaction. The life spirit seems to need this spur of pleasure and pain, and the taste of suffering and unease. She's always aiming for something, but she never reaches it. And there's something perverse in our life force. It is a remembering, some kind of taste that she wants to get back. The grief, which she knows came from her own choice. And she yearns for the pleasures which she knows have really harmed her. She's aspiring for the heights, but she turns her steps towards the depths. She's chosen chance and danger for her playfellows. She plays, she swings on this swing of fate. Where will it land her? And yet, says Shrivindo, her birth was not perverse. It's not from the lower depths, yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. All these different moods of hers are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are life's native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. In these last four lines, we have an example of Sri Aurobindo's view of life, which is so very different from that of many spiritual paths, many spiritual seekers who have found that life is just too much to deal with, and the best thing is to retreat or escape from it, if at all possible. No? And that in some way we have to control and limit the life force. That's not Sri Aurobindo's view at all. We'll discover more about that another time. But I love these last few lines. Yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. She's remembering her home, her moods, all those many, many different contrasting moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, her birthright, what none can take away from her. And bliss is her eternal home. That's where she has come from. She can always go back there. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.